sign.
Hey,
I see the sign.
Hang on, time's going now.
It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And tonight we're here to discuss the fifth episode of the third season of HBO's The Leftovers. This one is called It's a Matt World.
What do you think it meant, Paul?
I thought it was a shout out slash reference to the classic movie It's a Mad World that features an all-star cast of people on the lookout or searching frantically, racing one another in Australia for a treasure of some kind.
I like that, and I completely agree that that can be one layer of the title. I also want to add in another idea, especially parents like us with kids find ourselves saying things like, you know, it's me kind of thing. And I feel like there was a portion in this that our David Burton slash God character had a talking to with Matt about the idea that he did everything in his life, the sacrifices and the choices that he made, not on behalf of God, but on behalf of himself, and that he had been very selfish in all reality. And so I kind of take it like a Matt world, like it's all me. In reality, for him, it was so much more about the need to be heard and the need to be believed, almost more than what it was actually the belief in. It was really all about, can't someone just believe me, Matt? And less about believing in God or believing in the prophecy of what he thought was going to happen. His plans and his portion were what really mattered.
So it was all self-centered.
I don't want to say it in a super, super ugly way. I just want to say it like everybody's got their motives. And I think for Matt, the thing that was like sort of burning his fire was a lot about his own needs. And if you can remember way back when, to the beginning, when we found out that he was sick as a child, and that one of the things that he had an issue with having a baby sister, was that now the attention wasn't on him anymore, and that upset him. And it upset him to the point where he thought God gave him cancer in order to sort of punish him, he kind of had this twisted notion of like putting the attention back on himself, like he was kind of fine with it. And so it was kind of a mixed weird thing where like, I think that's just a part of his character where he needs attention and he wants people to listen and believe him. Not that we all don't. I mean, Oprah would not be famous if it were not her mantra that everyone wants to be heard. Everyone wants to feel like they matter. But in this case, he made it his entire life's work to be heard and to matter.
I like all that. Let's start with the second Damon Lindelof submarine we've ever seen in our lives.
Yeah, dude. So, all right, this was a really, to use your word, zany cold open. I thought it was really insane. It turned out to be on a French Navy submarine. We have this guy who turns on the music, that awful kind of French music that makes me want to turn it off immediately, or at least turn it down.
I need to know the context for music like that. Is that something that if you're in France, you can just turn on the radio and that's what you hear? Or is that really part of like a French musical or plays at the circus or some other kind of thing where you expect some idiocy to unfold?
I thought he turned it on. The character turned on that music. And so I'm saying that it's not music that was pleasing to anyone's ears, because I believe that that captain or the person who would have been in a high enough authority that would actually have a key around his neck came to him to say, turn that freaking music off. Like he used the music as a lure because he knew someone was going to come in and tell him to turn it off. So right. He had readied himself and, you know, stood in a way that he knew. So I'm going to say that this music is annoying to everyone. It is a known irritant. It would be the same as making a dog barking kind of thing or a siren sound or something. It would draw people in to say, turn that shit off.
In the added world of submarine danger, noise is all bad, even if it's music that they love. So this guy,
he grabs that key.
He rushes naked.
Away. Why do you think he has to be naked?
I haven't been able to figure that out.
I've heard a couple different things. Some people say because he was trying to run away from these people, and it's a little bit like being like a greased pig, like you want to have the least amount of anything that anyone could like grab a hold of you. So you're kind of more slippery and slick if you're like nude.
Well, you know, he didn't want to be encumbered when he needed to use his toes and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And then he wanted to be as flexible as he could be. So I don't know how his pants fit or his.
I think he's doing this for a reason. other than just mania. I think that there's some, the nudeness ties into that. Like, really? Maybe he's a closet GR person and didn't have his whites on him or something. I don't know.
Okay. I'm going to need a little more backup on that. Like, what else could he possibly be doing that would make any sense that he would need to be nude?
In a little way, like what happened on the submarine, it's not a perfect foreshadowing of what happens on the ferry. But, I mean, there's a lot of naked stuff on the ferry. And there's this Frasier phenomenon.
Right.
I did not find any sex groups, at least that were...
Groups.
Gives you that were
heebie-jeebies.
Advertising on the internet anyway. Maybe it's more of a word of mouth kind of thing. I don't know. Both things, both the orgy group and the guy shooting off a nuke, are people losing their minds at the end of the world in a way.
Okay.
Like how society just has decayed, you know, and like what they showed with the teenagers in the first season, how things had deteriorated to this point where people didn't care as much about stuff. So they had looser morals and all that kind of stuff. Well, we're several years past that now. Not everybody got better like Jill.
Okay, so I didn't take it anything like that, but I take your point. We'll get into sort of why I feel like they did the sex boat and everything as we move on here, but I didn't get those things that this was because of the sudden departure.
But that explains the nuke, yeah, the explosion.
Let's talk about this part for a second. Do you remember when Nora and Kevin were in the airport and they were going through security and that guy was getting turned away because he had the like hazmat-ish suit and he said, but there's going to be a nuclear explosion.
Yeah.
What is this all about?
Maybe him and the Frenchman are in the same end of the world club.
They're in cahoots?
You know, they subscribe to the same newsletter.
Okay, so this is several days before the 7th anniversary. What could possibly come of the idea of a nuclear explosion at an uninhabited South Pacific island? Is this simply a story device in which we have to ground all the planes? And so we're trying to create a reason?
Well, it sure did do that, yeah. It has to play into something besides just forcing what happened in this episode to happen. If it's tied into some sort of doomsday cult or whatever, rather than just this guy going crazy, I could believe it being a demonstration or some meaning like the frailty of life or something. I don't think it's anything as malicious as like, well, we know the fallout's going to go kill a few people, so there's that.
There is.
Otherwise,
that.
They would have just shot at some place where there were people.
I've heard some discussion about, you know, we talked a ton about the last wave. Could a in the ocean explosion cause a wave? Or somehow bust up the tectonic plates that could somehow create some sort of instability in our...
That I don't know. I mean, tidal waves are caused by undersea earthquakes, but I don't know.
Right.
I don't know if nukes... I mean, they're powerful, but I don't know if they're like on that scale that they could move a plate.
Could they like crack?
Again, I don't know. They said it went off at an island and then exploded.
So it exploded when it collided with the island?
Or right above it.
In the air? Nukes come from the air if it's in the sub?
Yeah, they shoot up and down. Weird. They don't go like torpedoes.
I had no idea. How does a submarine shoot it up into the air?
Well, they have to be at a certain depth because it can't just go forever. Otherwise, it uses up all its fuel, I suppose. But yeah, that's how they do it.
Messy. I don't know crap about nuclear weapons. I'm going to have to get back to my textbook reading.
I mean, someone who knows the ins and outs of French submarines might be able to say, no, they can shoot laterally. But
what do they do? Like, ha, right. That's not the way it works, Paul. Something like that.
Because the French do everything a little different than everybody else.
And they always have to go, ha, like that too.
The nasal laughing.
Okay, so typically we go character by character for our episodes these days, but honestly, guys, this one was so Matt-centric that it's pretty impossible not to just stick with Matt and go through the events of the evening because they really are so crazy. The people who are around him are so periphery. You know, they kind of bounce into his life a little bit, but this was so heavily Matt.
Right. So first order of business. Got to find a way to get to Australia. I know a guy who is just waiting to fly a plane to El Salvador, so why not fly that plane to Australia instead?
Well, so I understood that. That was the whole thing about playing within this story device, about how all of the passenger planes had been grounded, but somehow the relief planes were being allowed to fly, which is completely understandable. I thought there was a lot of little small things, like bringing a casserole when you're wanting to ingratiate yourself to the neighbors is like a ha-ha, I like that.
Well, and the appearance once again of the sum of $20,000.
Seemed
freaky.
We have seen that so many times. So $20,000 is the amount that Matt Jameson had buried in the yard for Kevin Sr. And he goes back in the little peanut butter jar. And then $20,000 was the amount that obviously Nora just had to bring for the departure microwave. And then now $20,000 is the amount that is the bribe in order to fly them.
It does make me wonder where he got the $20,000. Because if you remember, he, in the first season, had trouble with money, which is why he needed to go to the casino to win all the money. And then for a little while, he was flush. But then when he moved to Texas, he had nothing, you know, living in the garage of the church, basically. And then all of a sudden, now he's flush again. But at any rate, pilot says, yes, go to the airport.
The way that he gets him to do it by saying it's a rescue mission. Did you already start to feel a little bit like this was the type of manipulation that happens in Matt's world, where again, it's more important that Matt gets what he wants than like the truth or even exactly what this is all about? All right, so I think I might have a connection for the $20,000. So $20,000 is how much Mary pours on Jesus's feet as they gather for dinner. The oil, according to John's gospel, is worth 300, I'm not going to say this right, like denarii, and 300 times a laborer's daily wage in today's currency is about $8 an hour, 8 hours a day for 300 days. $20,000 of precious perfume is poured out on Jesus's feet.
Well, there you go. I would have never known that. Thank you. At the airport, Matt has it in his mind that he is part of a group of three wise men coming to Jesus, right? Or
right.
His own brand of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he is so disgusted when he sees Lori stomping down the tarmac toward his plane. He's like, ah, no girls, I said.
What about that? Do you think that is actually legit that he'd be this angry or this anything? Is this really fair or right?
He is super driven at this point, and he fights pretty unfairly with Lori because she, believe it or not, has come around to being the show's voice of reason. You know, like when they're on board the plane, he yells, it's the 7th anniversary. And she's like, of what? And he's like, the departure. And she's like, so? There's a certain logic to that. Basing any significance on an annual anniversary of an event, to an extent, is super coincidental. You know, if anything does happen. But Matt's put a lot of stock into it. Again, Lori, after all she's done, is now the voice of reason. And Matt, he pulls out the best line ever when she starts going off on him with the, did you bring your whistle, Lori? Because it sounds like you need to let off some steam. She's like, gets in his face and screams at him.
I didn't really think that it was very fair that he was this pissed. I mean, I kind of don't know what it's to him if somebody else comes along,
well,
honestly.
She's, I mean, compared to Michael and John, she's the greatest threat to the mission. If they just go along with what he says to an extent, then that's okay. But if she's there constantly questioning, nagging,
you're evil.
Interjecting.
Just because she's a woman, you're saying nagging?
No, just because she's presenting a counter argument. Doesn't matter her gender. Happens to be that she's a woman. But I don't think it would have worked as well if a man had come along and made the exact same argument, because the man wouldn't have had the same background with John and Kevin, you know?
I thought it was a little dramatic, and I kind of thought it would be like anybody who could get Kevin to come back to Jarden was really his main game. Hey, it served to talk out a lot of the pros and cons of what was happening, and that's really the device I felt like she played in the entire story, was just basically the yin and the yang to what he was doing.
That's exactly what she did. She she continues to do it, and he continues to kind of be shitty to her, like
when they
get to the ferry station.
Oh my god.
And he's like,
yeah,
three tickets, please.
The amount of times when Matt says something and the retort is just, fuck you, Matt, it like is over and over again. And it was like really funny. When he said three tickets, I was like, what? Matt, you're such a dick, like sincerely. But we have to go back to being on the plane a little bit, because there were certainly some portions there that needed to be pointed out. Matt got a lot of satisfaction out of the plane shaking when Lori was like, he's not the goddamn second coming of Jesus. And the plane shook.
Yeah.
Matt's grin was like, eat it.
Yeah.
Then, of course, when we have him reading the Bible and he's reading the book of Daniel and the lions, and we do think that that comes into play with Frasier and the lions.
For sure.
And all this portion. And, of course, the nosebleed. That pesky nosebleed.
I saw on the internet someone pointed out that Matt is the least graceful nosebleeder and boat thrower upper they've ever seen. And I have to agree.
Oh my God.
A big production out of his nosebleeds, not just little discreet droplets running out of his nose. They've got to come out in like blobs that cover entire biblical verses when they come out.
Turning on a faucet when his nose gets going, which is awful. It's terrible. I can't imagine what is going on up that nose and in his brain that is causing all this. We know it's probably cancer, but
it's a tumor.
Getting onto that ferry, they have to approach the lioness there, the head lioness. And she was quite a sight there. I honestly thought whenever we saw some previews of this, I really thought we were doing some Aborigine kind of stuff, because I guess I had my mind on Australia. And when I saw them kind of wearing like headdresses and stuff, I don't know, my head just went right back to seeing Senior doing the dances around the song circle. Like, my brain is like all the way back there. So when it turned out to be this story of a fertile lion, I mean, give us the story.
Well, as the song goes, Frasier was an aging lion. And I guess in lion years, he was 91. I guess in human years, that's not that old. It's more like 19 or something like that. But doesn't matter. He is rescued from one zoo, taken to another zoo where there's only female lions. And within a day, he has conceived lion cubs with all of them several times over by the time he dies.
And specifically, I guess some of those deets were that he was rescued from a Mexican circus and was like treated really poorly. And so he's like in really nasty, like flea bag kind of health.
Right.
And so he's completely a rescue mission, and then a rescue mission, That's the theme. And that these lionesses had actually killed like a bunch of.
So is Kevin going to turn into a sex machine?
Turn into. Exactly. Did you see the jogging scene, my friend? I'm pretty sure he's got this shit down. He was brought in just thinking that he was just going to live out his last days here. This was not anything like he was coming to sire any lions. And so when he came into the scene, these lionesses had already like done away with many potential suitors with them. And so the fact that he actually had had sex with all of them, oh my God, we read this article about it. And it was like, the way that this writer wrote it, it was like that the zoo person had, or the, it was really a preserve. I shouldn't be saying a zoo. He held his tongue admirably while he was trying to explain how thoroughly Frasier had done the business with each of these lionesses. It sounded like these lionesses were just lying around the preserve like, whoa, my God. Like, everyone was just, you know, passed out from the sexcapades. It was pretty hilarious the way these articles sounded.
It's funny how you state it like that, because if you look up Frasier the lion, every picture of Frasier, he has got his tongue lolled out of his mouth. Like, it's like 9 inches of tongue just hanging out of his mouth.
Wow.
Yeah. So this end of the world cult honors.
No, I don't know what you're saying, end of the world cult.
Because
now, that is your take on the situation. That is not what I saw at all. How it was explained to us was that they are a group that celebrates Frasier and his descendants.
Mm-hmm.
And they were escorting this lion to go to another zoo, and they bring him around the world in order to increase their population. I never heard anything about end of the world. I never heard anything that they were into fertility. That was their whole thing. They were into reproduction and sex and all this. And so they wanted to be a part of this procreation act of bringing the lion around to have sex with other lionesses.
I'm making a leap in that.
Well, go ahead.
In that people that may not have otherwise engaged in sex clubs in anticipation of something happening soon, they're like, well, whatever.
If you look at Matt and his viewpoint, he has sacrificed so much in the world, his own family, his child, his way of life. I mean, he was giving up everything for the church back in Mapleton. He just completely, you know, he was giving of himself, right? So when he looks around, I'm sure the entire world looks like the Fraser Club looks to you. Like everyone walking around with a baby in a stroller looks like a sex-crazed maniac. He must have felt like everyone's focus was on fertility and all this stuff because their focus was on fertility and they couldn't get pregnant. This wasn't happening for them. So I feel like, to me, I was seeing it through this like lens of Matt's eyes that I think the whole world looked like a bunch of sex-crazed miscreants with no focus, and they never had the bigger game in mind. They were just focused on their entertainment and their stuff, and that they never paid attention to real things.
Well, to an extent, he had found a way to deal with that. It was only once they threatened to pump him that he kind of lost it when he got the megaphone and said, "You should all be ashamed of yourselves." He was live and let live up to that point.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean. I don't think it was the end of the world, anything. I don't think it was anyone doing anything out of the ordinary. Sex clubs exist. These aren't people who think the world is going to end. These are just people who their focus is on having fun and pleasure and all that kind of stuff. And it's very, very different than a man of God would lead his life, you know, with the sacrifice and the lack of pleasure.
And I'm just saying it's influenced by the departure.
I don't think it is.
And the possible coming of the apocalypse.
No. I think absolutely no. I think all it
right.
exists
well,
every day.
You're not going to convince me
without
right
the
now.
Departure. So when we're trying to get onto this fairy of lust, we have this moment where the red hat man gets on and they say he is a friend of the captain. And I loved it when Matt's like, "So are we." And she's like, "Is that true?" And Michael's like, "No."
Michael
or Michael and John
cannot be associated with lies, deceit, anything. Anytime that Matt has wanted him to come on, Michael, at least, you know, side with me. And yes, he's on your side, but he's not going to lie. He's never going to lie.
Dude, even when they were on the plane and he's like, "I need to know you're with me and I need you that you will do whatever it takes to get Kevin back." And Michael's like, "Let's just hear him out and see what he wants to do." Like, I was like, that's not the answer he was looking for.
Mm-mm.
So what did you think about this test? Tell me the filthiest joke that you know. And here's Lori stepping up to offer one right away.
I thought that was hilarious. And I thought that it was the quickest way that she could determine his comfort level with obscenity, basically vulgarity. He had to fire back like he did. I mean, if he would have come back with a regular priest joke, no way. They're swimming to Australia.
Do you know how they have this this little saying that they're told about come midnight that no one should mention his name lest that man becomes him?
Yes.
Does that kind of remind you of Bloody Mary kind of ish superstition-y kind of weirdnesses?
Or like the instructions for Gremlins?
Yeah, that there's something about midnight and then there's something about saying like a boogity's name. Like, weren't you not supposed to say Candyman too? Remember Candyman? If you say Candyman so many times.
It's getting late. I wouldn't keep saying that.
I know. I'm freaked out already. Or like Beetlejuice, say his name 3 times. Like all this stuff. I don't know. Isn't there something like a little bit a part of our culture that somehow after midnight, after the like witching hour kind of times, that if you say this boogity words or whatever, then all of a sudden you're going to somehow be like inhabited or something? Like a demon, something evil
right.
This way comes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, which is very not Christian. Right? It's more pagan to kind of believe in that kind of,
I guess so,
kind
yeah.
of incantation kind of stuff. But that's very funny that would be something that Matt runs into in this episode.
And doesn't take seriously, right? Like yeah. Doesn't follow their rules. He's got his own rules of stuff that like people should and should not be doing. He doesn't like it, what David Burton's doing, but he's got his own rules, but he doesn't follow their rules or listen to their rules. Again, I think going back to that selfishness, like my rules, my thing, the way I do it is right. The way everybody else does things is wrong, wrong, wrong.
Now that you brought up David Burton in that context, that's pretty much the next thing that shows up on my radar is when he goes up on deck to find the man with the red hat, who everyone says considers himself God, and confronts him, only to receive this mass-produced playing card-sized FAQ sheet that reads kind of hysterically, telling you things like evolution is true, but it's not how you think, and Jesus isn't his son, and all these other things.
I thought the funniest thing was honestly the hammer throws the one you can't remember.
Right,
because that's kind of hilarious.
Because he's a decathlete.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like we've been in those positions where we've like sat around talking, doing like Trivial Pursuit type stuff, and it's like, what's the last one?
You know,
and
you're like javelin.
Yeah, and it's like, it's the hammer throws, the one you can't remember. It's like, ah! So it's kind of like David Burton kind of has his finger on the pulse.
It's like those Facebook gimmicks that tell you the number you're thinking of after it goes through several permutations,
right?
But it's on his card.
Right. I think that's kind of awesome. I mean, a lot of the things that he said, you know, were definitely picking at Matt for sure, every single part of it.
Oh, Matt cannot live with this. I mean, there was nothing that could really detour Matt from what he is set out to do in this episode. But blasphemy on this scale, he has to deal with before he can get back to job one.
I think it's interesting the way that you just phrased that in saying that nothing's going to stop him from thinking it has to go his way on this mission, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because when he's talking with John and he's saying how important it is to get Kevin back to Jardin, and they're trying to convince him, like, we're not going to make it back, man, by like the 14th.
Yeah.
He says, you know, Jardin's so important because that's where my wife woke up and that's where I was able to have a child. It was fascinating for John to turn around and say, and that's where my wife left me and where I lost my child. So there ain't nothing special about it. I honestly thought, again, that just was like another nail in the coffin of like, Matt, how can you look in the face of John and say, Jardin's the place where nothing bad happens?
Mm-hmm.
When you know that his wife left him and you certainly know that his daughter died. Oh my God. And that he went through not just died, but like went through this excruciating missing and, you know, the whole thing.
He's not really
happened.
Fair with John, because later on, when he's trying to enlist John to come and help him beat up David Burton.
Oh my God. I loved the wording for all that, Paul.
And he says, what happened to your wrath? He's trying to bait him.
Big time.
And he's telling him that the man that he was, the violent man, instead of the peaceful man that we know from this season, he wants the violent man back, the one that denied him and said that he didn't believe him when he was told about Mary waking up but then going back into her coma.
Mm-hmm.
He wants that man back. Why would he want that back? John considers this like he's gotten past that. He's become a better person.
I think it's because he does not have value at that time for the place that John supposedly is at. I still have a lot of question marks about whether John is at true peace, because I've mentioned this before that I just feel like there's another level to John that is not uncovered yet. Because to me, he's too passive. He's too calm. He's too everything. And here's the thing. When he says, where's that wrath and everything? John doesn't answer. It's Lori who butts in and says, he found peace. Mm. Well, if someone else has to say on your behalf that you found peace, I don't feel good about it. I don't feel compelled to believe that situation.
He's making an effort. That's a start, right?
But that's okay. But here's the deal. I think that some of the most menacing people in the world have no problem at all waiting and biding their time. I don't know where this could possibly lead. I mean, if you're talking about having some surprise moments, John turning out to have this all been an act for him these last couple of episodes for us would not surprise me, only because it's so freaking suspicious how suddenly passive he is. I understand
why the heck he's on this trip.
I understand everything that they said about that Lori basically talked him down through all of her psychiatric skills. And then on the flip, Matt takes credit for some of his peace by saying, well, we gave him faith and that's where he's found strength and everything. The wording that they use in that argument back and forth when he's like, we need to go and make him reap. And then he's like, we're not reaping anyone. Like, okay, so let's get to where Matt finally does this confrontation with David Burton.
Okay. At the center of Matt's attention is gone beyond the blasphemy. It's now that he has seen the man who calls himself God throw another man overboard. Matt is on this floating Sodom and Gomorrah where he can't find any redeemable souls that will help him fish the guy out of the water. He doesn't find any help even with the ship's crew. The captain doesn't believe him, and the captain won't even lift a finger to help him. So he takes matters into his own hands. His friends won't help him. That's when he gets the wheelchair and the axe, and he goes and finds David Burton and ties him up on a wheelchair and takes him in front of, did they name this line? Or was
it
just
a descendant of
Frasier. So you could take him anywhere, I suppose, but putting him in front of the lion, what do you think we're supposed to read into that? There's long been a lot of Christian iconography with lions, and here we are talking to this guy who says he's God.
To be honest with you, I thought he brought him there because he was going to literally throw him to the lion.
That's kind of what I thought,
That's too. What I thought was going to happen. That's where I thought we were going with that. Somehow he was going to start threatening him, acting like he was going to open the lion's cage or do something like that. I mean, he even had the axe in hand. So when you think about like busting open the cage, I didn't see if there was an actual, what type of locker or whatever was on there, but anything could have happened in that moment. It's not what I expected to happen. That is for darn sure.
Let me give you just a quick review of what the Daniel and the Lion's Den story is, just in case you missed that day in Sunday school. Daniel was a prosperous businessman who was also very famously pious. All the other local businessmen were jealous of Daniel. And they conspired against him. So they made up some sort of law or regulation or something that said, all right, for a month, you can worship no one or nothing except for the king. Daniel said, no, I'm going to continue to worship God. So he got thrown in jail for that. And the king had to enforce the law, which was to feed him to the lions. But after they stuck him in the lion's den, the lions didn't eat him. So after a day, the king let him out and told everybody it must be because he is so pious that he was spared.
That's why I kind of thought that he was going to use the lion as some sort of test.
Mm-hmm.
That he was going to either push him in the cage and see if the lion backed off. If the lion backed off, then he must be God.
In a way, I think that it is. Later on, we find out that he does not pass the test.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just thought that was like a delayed gratification moment for me because I felt like that move was going to happen earlier. And then for it to happen at the end was like, oh, damn. You know, like, so he did have his moment of the man versus the lion and he did lose. Let's talk about that conversation a little bit between him and David Burton. So David Burton claims to be God, and he claims that he doesn't need to tell the authorities that he threw this guy over because
he is the authority.
Going back just a little bit in this whole thing, because I do feel like this is a metaphor of Matt's entire journey, his moments with David Burton. I feel like when he sees the man thrown overboard, I feel like that is representative of what he thinks is going on with Kevin. I can't say exactly what the thrown overboard part is, except for just that he thinks Kevin needs to be rescued in some form or fashion, and that somehow he needs to bring attention to this man and no one else will listen. And watching him walk through the boat for hours and hours on end, yelling and screaming and pointing and going to the captain and going to everybody who should be taking action, and everybody just pushing him back and basically saying, like, too bad. And ultimately the captain even saying, unless David Burton himself comes to me and says that he did it, then I'm not going to do anything about it. And that's a lot what I feel like happens to Matt this entire time, where people are basically like, until God steps down and says, Kevin is the son of God, we don't want to hear about it. Until we hear it from God's lips, we're not listening to you. And I feel like that's a lot of what is told to Matt over and over again. And I do appreciate that ultimately he feels like, you know, they have that moment between John and Lori where, you know, he spills the beans about Evie and he realizes that he is being a real asshole to John and he is like tearing things down. You know, when he says, you know, I'm sorry, our job is supposed to be to protect each other. I think he actually, in many ways, although he said he was sorry, I didn't feel like he was humbling himself. I felt like he was actually putting himself on another level, like saying, like, you guys have to be protected. You guys are the sheep. I'm the shepherd. I'm supposed to be protecting you sheep who don't listen and who don't know anything.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I need to take care of this situation. And so I'm going to go lay down, blah, blah, blah. You know, basically giving them an out to not have to pay attention to what he was doing because the shepherd needs to go handle the situation.
Okay.
And ultimately, that's even how I felt about if you think of the lions lay with the lambs, blah, 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 blah. We've got a lot of different things going on here with lions and sheep, the general concept of it. So when he goes down and he's talking to David Burton and he starts off, like, I kind of felt like I was getting this imagery of very like Jack Nicholson in The Shining with the axe. And he was almost deranged, you know, standing against the wall being like, you're going to answer me kind of stuff. I thought it was intense. Did you think he was going to do something more disgusting, like hit him with the axe or do anything more?
Well, Matt has it in him to commit acts of physical violence. However, the only time I thought there was going to be any violence was when he eventually freed David Burton. So no, I did not believe that Matt was going to hurt David Burton. I mean, he Because he approached him so cavalierly at the beginning of their conversation by doubting David Burton as saying that he was God. He was joking and kidding with him, like, you deny paternity, you know, that line.
I thought that was actually a really bizarre way to say that, like a very modern way of saying something that, I don't know, it was very like, and Judge you Judy. Are not the father, right. Like Maury Povich.
Right.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I thought that was a strange way to say it. But I think the whole thing, as far as I was concerned, is, I mean, he confronted every bit of what Matt's life is all about and just kind of ripped it apart. This is the first time I ever heard the concept of Jesus not rising from the dead because he had a twin brother. I never heard such a thing. I know there's plenty of people who have other beliefs, like perhaps he wasn't completely dead, that there were different ideas of, like, I guess in the Gospels it says that he died unusually quickly, that it usually takes people a lot longer to die during a crucifixion. That's the suffering portion of it. So there was some amount of thought of, like, or theories out there that perhaps the disciples have given him something, some sort of herb or something that made it appear that he was dead, so that he was taken off the cross earlier than he would have, and therefore maybe wasn't actually all the way dead. And so that's why he could rise again, basically.
Okay.
And other ideas too, that perhaps that he had like a younger brother, or that he had someone else in his place on the cross. I know all these things sound horrible to people who really feel strongly that know there's like one story of exactly what happened with Jesus. And I know it hurts your ears. I never knew there was so much controversy or all these different ideas of how it could have happened. I thought it was either you believed in this story or you did not. But I didn't know that there had been so many other concepts of how this could have happened. Leave it to the leftovers to always make me go and do some homework and be like, I am just enlightened now that there are groups of people who believe these other things. I'm inclined to want to look harder at the twin theory, not because I necessarily think it's true concerning Jesus in that story, but when I think about Kevin, I think about how the twins with the, you know, would you kill the twin if the other one could cure cancer? You know, this is not a spoiler because episode names are out there, but there's an episode coming up 2 from now, so it would be number 7, that is called The Most Powerful Man in the World and His Twin Brother. And so I am a little inclined to want to think about David Burton's concept of a twin. And does maybe Kevin have a twin, or is there anything else to this? I don't know.
So I've been trying to figure out what it is that David Burton could have been. To an extent, whatever he is might explain whatever Kevin is.
Okay, so do you feel like the whole idea that we've seen David Burton now, we know at least twice. We've seen him in The International Assassin and in You Live Here Now. If you guys remember, in International Assassin, David Burton is on the bridge and he is the one that yanks Kevin out of the car. And he is like questioning him and saying, you know, if you kill this girl, you'll never be the same.
Interesting parallel there, how this week David Burton throws a guy off the boat. He makes a decision about another person's life and ends it, right?
Mm.
And on the bridge,
he puts the noose around
Kevin's neck and is just about ready to push him over the edge of the bridge, but he gives him a choice that he can make for his own self. But he was going to default to, I'm going to just put you in the noose and do it myself.
True. Very true. And it was very similar if you think about actually the struggle that happens on the bridge with Kevin, yanking him out the way and then watching him fight back and forth with the man up on the railing of the ship. Intrigue. And so then the other time that we see him is he is sort of the antagonist at the karaoke bar. He's kind of poking at Kevin and being like, what, you don't want to sing? That type of thing. It's like a proven statistic that more people are afraid of public speaking or something like karaoke singing versus actually dying. Some people would have chosen never to do it and then they would have stayed in purgatory. How like nuts is that?
You found a cool connection to The Last Wave when David Burton was on the bridge. He told Kevin, what was the exact wording? Nothing's more real than it is right now or something to that effect.
Oh, yes. Okay. So in The Last Wave, if you guys remember, there was this idea of the two states of living. Basically, you have like the everyday life that we all live. And then you have this dream world life that they suggest is more real than real. David Burton says something like, no, friend, you know, this is real. This is more real than real.
Yeah, it can't be a coincidence.
I don't think it can be a coincidence. I mean, this whole idea of living in this dreamlike world where you perceive things on every level, spiritually, physically, mentally, emotionally, everything compared to the way that we live our everyday world, which is pretty closed off. For the most part, you know, we kind of act a little robotic and just go through our lives trying not to absorb people's conversations and emotions and everything. We kind of push everything away. Like in this dreamlike world, it's the complete opposite. Like you're trying to soak in everyone else's vibe, and that makes it more real than what you consider real life.
There's something about the David Burton character, how he has some facility with and familiarity with the hotel side of reality.
He's a little like Virgil in that way. He was a little guide-esque.
Yeah, the basic idea is that he's been there before. He knows how it works. Oh, you can take the trials or you can sing or whatever, you know, whichever gets you back to life, it's okay. The timing doesn't really work out so that David Burton was dead during International Assassin or I Live Here Now. He'd already been reported alive.
Yeah, but that's
But that doesn't mean that he's not dabbling in the hotel.
I think he is. I think he's doing exactly what Virgil did. He's going back. He already had his original experience. And he is going back. Do you think that it's possible that Kevin is going to play that role?
I believe that Kevin has that power.
Is he going to leave all the world here in order to do this back and forth business? Guide people into the next life in some form or fashion?
It might be that he has to for some reason.
But do you think he will?
Yeah, I don't think he's going back to Jarden to be police chief at the end of this thing.
I don't either.
I was also kind of wondering if perhaps being this way is some classifiable aspect of the supernatural. Like, he's not God, obviously. He gets eaten by a lion. But could he be an avatar of God? Like, he has access to God's knowledge and wisdom and all that kind of shit. He's not God, but he gets a little bit of godlike power there, just a sliver of it.
I don't know why he would go around to say he is God. Like, I'm not sure what the point is, unless it's that more in that, like, we're all God kind of ways, you know, and I don't mean that in a nasty way, but like more like we're all parts of the same thing. Just like, you know,
we are Groot.
Yeah. Kind of the idea of like we're all nature. We're all made of the same particles that are in stardust. We're all, our DNA is like just the tiniest bit off from like plants and everything. Like, it's freaky when you really look at how little difference there is. Is it possible that it's like we all are the force? Is it possible that he just means it's something like that? Unless, I mean, we're taking a very Christian, very Western way of looking at what God is. If you took it from the standpoint of like a Native American spirit kind of feeling, or even the Aborigines, then I don't want to say it in like as if it's blasphemy, like I am God, but more like God is in me, and so therefore, or he works through me.
Well, I think you're onto something there, because Matt is approaching this guy who says he's God from his Christian training, and he cannot deal with the idea of this man saying that he's God. However, that same training kind of cripples him from being able to look at the idea of God being anything other than what his training has prepared God to be.
Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I don't mean to be silly and cliche, but it's like that song, like, what if God was one of us? What if he was just a stranger on a bus? How would that rock your world if God was sitting next to you at work? If God is in everything and he created everything, then is it so far-fetched to think that our concept that he would be sort of like floating above us versus he's actually in everything? Why is one idea more ridiculous or more rude or whatever than the other?
Now that I think about that a little bit more, it does remind me of the whole concept of American Gods, which is another show on right now that's based on a Neil Gaiman book that centers around the idea that when a group of people comes together to live, they bring with them their belief systems. If part of those belief systems is some kind of deity, then that deity lives among them. And depending on how basically popular they are and how many people believe in them, the greater the status of that living incarnation of their deity. So in American Gods, you have all these groups of people that had been worshipped at one point or another on this continent, but because they're not the Christian God, they're kind of falling on hard times. You can't be Odin in North America and be living the high life. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
That's the basic concept there. And that kind of reminds me of what you're talking about, this idea that believing in God this one certain way is super restrictive.
It's very narrow-minded, and for sure.
And in the way that this show has already taken Aboriginal beliefs and Christian beliefs and the Muslim end of the world cycle beginning anew and all that kind of stuff, there's no, I think the creators are saying, there's no reason to just look at it as the King James Bible is the only way to look at this.
And that's not saying that the King James Bible has to be wrong. I think it's beautiful and actually 100% jives with the Christian belief that God is everywhere. God's always watching us. God's all those types of words to me doesn't necessarily mean a man with a white beard in the clouds physically watching you. What if he's inside of all your neighbors and all of your children and all of your, you know, people at work, and everyone's watching you? You know, like that is also God is also watching, you know, like there's maybe you already believe in it and you just didn't really think about it in that way. You know, this may not even be confronting your beliefs in a negative way. This might just be saying, you actually do believe this. Like, you actually do think God created everything and that everything came from Adam. Therefore, we're all a little piece of God, right? And if we're all a little piece of God, then someone saying, I am God, even though that hurts our ears a little bit to be like, oh, that sounds like a little bit like you need to humble yourself over there. It's not actually like wrong, a Christian belief might be.
Matt has a hard time with it.
Very well delivered by Christopher Eccleston, as well as Bill Camp, who plays David Burton. I felt like their back and forth was very intriguing because it starts off with Matt being so angry and so just demanding answers. That's how a lot of people might be with God. They want answers, especially in a time of crisis. And the way that the conversation smoothly transitions into a place where many of us are also with God, Matt's eyes and his voice actually changes and he starts to talk like a child. He looks like where the light is hitting his eyes and he says like, you know, could you save me again? But he says it in this really babyish child voice. It's remarkable because that's the other way you come to God, when we need help, begging in our most innocent voice, like, could you please, please have mercy? That the way that was handled was amazing.
Chris Eccleston did a great job. And David Burton, man, I mean, he he did everything right to make us think he was going to do one thing or another. Like when he got his hands loose out of the restraints and then he grasped his hands into fists and rolled them around, kind of like you might pop your knuckles before you're about to break somebody's neck.
That was some serious stuff. Even the way that the conversation was, when you look back at it, David Burton really says very little. He just continues to say, why?
He does.
Why? Doesn't that go back to many of the religious, you need to like examine your own self, think about why you do the things you do and who you are and what's your purpose and all those things. It's all very introspective. It's pretty fascinating that honestly, quote unquote, God answers all the questions.
It reminded me of how a child may ask a question in a setting like Sunday school, and then when the teacher gives her best answer and the kid says why, they get about three whys in before they're stuck and they have to say, because God made it that way. And it's so, I guess it's funny to turn that situation around and have God asking why, and have you have to answer and come up with some reason for that.
This is also a tiny metaphor for the larger thing that we've said about the leftovers. It wasn't about the answer. It was about the journey getting there. It wasn't about what the last statement was between quote unquote God and Matt. It was about all those whys in between. It was about the why did you choose to do that? And why did you choose to do that? And why would you sacrifice? And why did you let your wife go? And it was about those whys that made the show. It wasn't about the final answer, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. They've done a brilliant job of encapsulating the entire experience for me over and over again. And I know that this episode turns off a lot of people on the surface. I think it seems
vulgar
and without substance. If you didn't recognize David Burton from other episodes, if you didn't understand, you know, any of the parts of what we're talking about, that, you know, some of this could be looked at in different ways. The futility of everything Matt has done in his entire life. Every other Matt-centric episode has made us cringe because he gets into these situations and he's like getting punched in the face after he wins the casino winnings. You know, it's like, it's all just like, oh, yes. Like, I mean, it's just so futile. Everything, after everything he did to care for Mary, everything, pray for a hope for a child, and they leave him. Like, mm-hmm. It's all so heartbreaking that for me, of course the conversation with God would go as it did. Of course he wouldn't get the answers he wanted. Of course no one would listen to him that the man fell overboard or was pushed overboard. It's a Matt world.
Yeah.
The faith and the concept of who believed him and when they believed him was really brilliantly sprinkled throughout the whole episode of like, you know, will you believe me if this happened? Will you believe me if that happened? Will you pursue this man with me? Kevin, will you pursue this man with me? David Burton, he asks over and over to the loyalty of Michael and John over and over again and in different ways. And some of the times they just deflect him and they're like, yeah, you know, well, I'll be there. Or they'll say it in really passive, like, of course we believe you. And it's like when he finally flipped the switch with John and he's like, just like you believed me about not having molested my wife. He really had a lot of moments here that really led to this interesting ending for him in this episode.
It was a very Matt ending because that snap and ta-da was the sound of Matt's connection to his faith breaking, I think. I guess there's just like this really pathetic irony that since Burton is revealed to have been the killer that Matt said he was, all of a sudden Matt has a lot of freaking credibility and people like you just mentioned that didn't have faith and now all of a sudden do. They would, you know, but now he doesn't have his anymore.
It's not necessarily about the justice for David Burton. It was about rescuing that man. And so watching David Burton get mauled by the lion, while satisfying for most of us in that moment, because it was like, all right, he got what he wanted. He never wanted that. He wanted them to rescue the man alive overboard. And the reason why you could understand why your heart would just sink, because it's like, it was all for nothing. Who cares if David Burton is dead now? Who cares if the police get him or don't get him? Who cares? That man, the man who was overboard, is gone. And no one cared that he died. And no one cared anything about him. And I think we also had that little moment back, way back, when he was talking about the legacy of the Pillar Man and saying, like, can't you give a man a little grace? Can't you let a man have a legacy? That kind of stuff. I think that for him, the concept that he would have gone overboard and no one would have even cared that he died. Mm-hmm. No one. And that just happened over and over again. Don't you have the list of the people? Nope, don't have the list. Well, don't you care that a man's over? Nope, I don't care that he died. The captain of the ship, all the people who should have cared and should have stuck up for that man didn't. And I feel like that's how he felt his whole life. The people who should have stuck up for him, the people who should have cared whether he lived or died, he didn't feel supported. Now, when you flip the script and say, but Matt, you didn't listen to Mary. And John points that out. If you had given her more control, she would have stuck around. You didn't listen to the people who loved you. Lori points it out. I understand you've called Kevin 20 million times. How many times have you called Nora, your sister, who's stuck over there too? You know, like the people who you're sort of like demanding all of this loyalty from, how loyal have you been to them? Mm-hmm. How much have you listened and been there for them? And how much have you just demanded their support and their encouragement? And maybe you messed this up. I thought it was interesting that the book that David Burton was reading was called Lonely on the Mountain. It's about this solitary wandering Sackett brothers make a stand together to save one of their own. The one brother faces starvation or a hanging if the other brother can't drive a herd of cattle from Kansas to British Columbia before winter. To get to Logan, he must brave prairie fires, buffalo stampedes, and a Sioux war party. But worse trouble awaits, for a mysterious enemy shadows Sackett's every move across the Dakotas and the Canadian Rockies. The brother has never abandoned another brother in need, and he will bring aid to Logan or die trying. Matt is going to die trying, in my opinion. And I also think the fact that he jumped overboard and was willing to sacrifice himself to rescue that man, there's going to be a moment where he has the opportunity to step in for Kevin. Kevin, it could be John, it could be Michael, for God's sake, but I do think there's going to be a moment when he can step in and he knows he's a dying man, kind of Jack Ruby's it and decides, I'm going to die anyway, so I'm just going to try to take somebody else out who I think is bad in the meantime.
He has set up his whole life for that moment, even though God calls him out on it and says, no, you did all that because you thought I was looking. It still amounted to a certain amount of sacrifice and doing for others that just kind of comes naturally to him one way or the other.
Well, go slower. Is it about doing for others in the way that you're saying it? Or is it about doing things to get people to believe and listen to him, listen to his stories and believe in his things?
Well, it's more like the second one. Otherwise, you wouldn't bring over a casserole.
Right. Right. I like Matt as a person, but I think he's a cautionary tale about people who maybe think that they are being helpful to others in their desire to help, like, convert those people or make those people understand what they should believe in. And there's like a little bit of a lack of rubber meets the road about actually supporting those people and actually being there. Like, he just used that pilot. He used the pilot's belief and used it all to get him. Like, the pilot really needed to stay with his mother. His mother was dying, you know?
Right.
I mean, it was...
She didn't look long for this earth.
Right. And it was very manipulative for him to use the concept of faith. And even the man, Arturo, glances at the crucifix. He's like calling upon his own faith and being like, okay, I have to do it because my faith is this strong. Therefore, I need to do it. I think Matt is a good person, but I think that he may have used the concept of believing and believing him as being more important than believing in the greater good and in the bigger picture. It's a little weird. I know that that's like very hard to tease out, and I hope I'm saying it remotely clear enough, but I really think it was, if someone could say, look, Matt, if you just go sit in your house for the rest of your life and don't say anything, the whole world is going to be fine. I don't think that would be okay with Matt. He would say, but I have to be the one to tell them. Well, are you more important, or is the message and the belief part more important? And I think, unfortunately for Matt, I honestly think it's that he had to be the one to tell them and they needed to believe him.
Because it's a Matt world.
It's a Matt world, right?
So you have a pretty strong prediction there. You can't say when, can't say how, but some sort of martyrdom / self-sacrifice seems to be on the menu.
Because
here,
I think it's his ultimate redemption moment. If you have kind of realized that maybe you've been selfish your whole life and maybe your priorities got a little skewed, you thought you were doing it for this reason and maybe you were doing it for that reason, your ultimate deathbed moment is for you to be able to be selfless.
My predictions are not quite as good. Mine are more like, I bet they find Nora right away. And Nora's like, yeah, I'm not helping you find him.
Uh-huh. I totally believe that. Well, so here's some other things. I think our track has got to lead us to outside Perth, right?
Perth seems important, but that's the entire continent away from where they are, isn't it?
I don't really care. I think that we've got to somehow end up outside Perth, because the way that they mentioned that that's where David Burton died, and then that is also where everything happened with Senior Garvey when he had his God's moment having to do with the hotel. And that, I don't understand why it wouldn't be some sort of, I'm just using the word like vortex.
Well,
right?
I said like early in our podcast that this show has special places. Jarden being a special place. Mapleton maybe being a special place.
No, I don't think it is. But Jarden, I think it is, because of the way that they could bury things in the ground like the bird.
Right. Perth. Could it be that David Burton wasn't special? He just happened to land in a special spot, right? And maybe it is, maybe that's true, that they got to get there in order to, that special spot's just as good as the Jarden special spot in order to fulfill whatever Kevin's destiny is. You mentioned to me a certain similarity between the shot of the back of Matt's head with the shot of the back of Kevin Senior's head earlier this season and kind of the stuff surrounding that scene.
You know, it would not surprise me at all if our last scenes is the back of someone's head, whether it's be the back of Nora's head or the back of Kevin's head. I'm not sure. But the way that the first episode of this final season has us looking at the back of Senior's head with all the chaos going on. And then this one has the back of Matt's head with all the chaos going on. And both of them having that sort of moment of acceptance and sort of like their internal struggle to keep making things go the way they were has kind of ended. For Senior, it was like he was trying to still be the police chief and trying to kind of keep order and stuff. And he like had a break with that reality. But then he was like, yeah, you know what? I'm gonna start listening to some other voices. And I know that sounds like, well, that's for the bad. Well, however you look at it, I want to say maybe he gave in to the dreamlike world. He gave up that day-to-day grind thinking that we all have, right?
Okay.
That I got to keep doing my 9-to-5. I got to keep doing this. Matt, I felt the same way. He had been on this mission, and I'm going to consider that his day-to-day grind. It's not the same thing. It's not a 9-to-5 job, but it was like his daily passion to have to do this. We watched him break from that. It didn't, again, matter that there was, that David Burton was necessarily attacked and everything. I mean, it of course did on some level, but I feel like he just, like, he accepted the situation for what it was. And I want to use the phrase almost like he like leaned into it. When Lori asked, are you okay? And he said, actually, Lori, I'm dying. That's the first time we've seen him say it out loud. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's much like we had with Senior Garvey of being like, I hear the voices and I started listening.
Okay.
I'm not trying to say that Matt's lost his mind. I'm trying to say that he's accepted, leaning into a different way of thinking.
Okay.
Whether that's good, bad, or otherwise, I don't know. What did you think of that very last moment of him turning back into the camera and staring into our eyes and saying, that's the guy I've been telling you about?
I think he means David Burton and God at the same time, because he has been talking about God his whole life, right? The God that he knew and believes in isn't there for him anymore. And for, to an extent, was just eaten by a lion, you know?
From what I hear you saying, I think you're saying God has turned his back on Matt, and that's why Matt is dying. If you go with the nature cycle, everyone dies. God's not spiteful. He's not killing Matt. His cycle is ending. That's true. He gave him his son. Family line continues. I think that he has acceptance that his life is coming to an end. I don't know if that has to be equated to his faith in God is over. I think acceptance doesn't necessarily mean I don't believe in God anymore.
I'm taking it more like God was never there for him. I think what breaks Matt down is when David Burton slash God explains the fallacy of Matt's whole existence. You know, you did all this because you thought I was judging. I wasn't. I took that to mean I wasn't even paying attention to you.
Oh, and see, and I'm going to take it a different way. I'm going to say you don't have to tap dance for God. God loves you as you are. God's happy with you, is proud of you as you are. You don't have to do a dog and pony show every day in order for God to love you. So all of these extreme things that you did were all unnecessary, they were, as many people we know who've maybe fallen very far away from traditional religion would say, they were man-made laws. Y'all made them up to begin with. They never needed to be there. I loved you. I always loved you. You didn't have to do this.
Well, this was a heck of an episode. I mean, we watched it with friends, and it's always a little awkward to watch 45-minute extended sex scenes with other people.
It definitely, I think that, I mean, on rewatch, we had to keep being like, no one can come downstairs while we're watching TV, which I know The Leftovers is always a little difficult in that regard. But I think for the most part, I hope that everybody is taking a little bit of time and trying to listen to all the different layers of messages that were put forth by these episodes. I don't think that they're so one note, I don't think that there's one message to get. I think it depends on where you are in your phase of life and where what you're doing. I think if you have kids versus not having kids, I think if you've had cancer and been cancer free and you have the same fear that maybe Matt has had his whole life, you probably have a different viewpoint than someone else who is maybe at the end of their life and feeling differently about it. To someone who just had a baby. I don't know. Everyone could have very, very different vantage points. I would love to hear what your vantage points are and, you know, what you are taking away from this, because I have to think that everyone is doing the same thing we are and just bringing their personal experiences to inform and fill in the blanks. It sort of feels like The Leftovers can be compared to like a giant Mad Lib in many ways. And it's like, depending on your personal experiences and where you fill in the blanks, it's like God is blank. And it just depends on what you've experienced and what your feelings are about the situation. And then that's going to start informing the next sentence and the next sentence down.
I think to an extent, this episode was kind of gleefully on the behalf of the creators filled up with spectacle. But I think if I had to make a bet, I would bet that Damon or one of those guys in the writer's room said, I don't care how it happens, but I want a lion to eat this guy at the end of the episode. So make it happen. Make a lion happen. So they did. That's my bet. I have no proof of that. But the rest of it, doesn't it seem like it could come from that one kernel?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I kind of think about that a lot of times, like how we were saying, like, ultimately they have to be broken up, Nora and Kevin. Now let's just get them there. Okay, how about he talks to a koala bear? You know, like, there's just like all this stuff that has to happen. But I do have a question for you on that. Do you think that given this whole, like, sort of the way that they can come back to life kind of stuff, I'm trying to think about the idea of the lion. And if there's some sort of like you crossed a certain line that you like cannot regenerate, like what if he bit his head off? Like, is there some sort of death that
like vampires?
Is there some sort of death that you can't come back from? What if it wasn't, I want a lion to kill him? What if it was, he needs to die in a way that you can't regenerate from?
It's a good question.
Could ripping someone's head off by a lion be the way?
When Virgil killed himself, he seemed to approach it in a very permanent way. And then he drank the water on the other side.
He blasted his brains.
Yes.
So if you think about it.
Voodoo can't fix that. Like a gut shot, you know, kind of that works, you know, but that's not the same as losing brain matter.
Yeah, no, you can't do that. So that's what I'm asking is, do you think that really the instruction was make him die in a way that you can't regenerate from? And it can't be a suicide. It's got to be something that's really where like his head was ripped off from his body.
It could be.
Or do you think this death even leads to that? Is it regenerative?
I don't know that we'll see David Burton on the physical plane anymore.
I don't think we will, but don't you think you'll see him in the hotel again?
I do.
Don't you think we should pack our bags because we're heading to the hotel again?
I think we are.
I think we are as well. And I kind of wonder who else we might see there at this point. I think we might see Matt back on the other side. He may go in the very next one and we may see him in 7 and 8 in the hotel.
Crazy.
It's possible. He didn't go away. He just went away from here, right?
Yeah.
Very intriguing. There's a funeral poem that that is often read in our family where it's the concept is, I haven't gone anywhere, I've just stepped into the next room, and you should speak of me as you've always spoken to me, you should say my name as you always have, we should share the same jokes, and there should be no sadness about it because I've literally just stepped into the next room. And I feel like if you think about that in this world, it's very much like that. Like, I'm not exactly sad to see Matt quote unquote die, so long as we just see him in the next room. It doesn't actually wig me out at all, which is a pretty big thing to say about characters that you love, but the way that they've been able to show you the next room kind of is comforting.
That's very nice to a note to end on there.
Well, thanks for listening, you guys. Let us know what you think.
Thanks a lot. Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software. Our website, dailyreview.com, that's DALEY review.com, Facebook or Twitter, or wherever you find us, please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.